This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFK. If you're not already a member, consider joining with us and keep free speech alive.
El programa que escuchas sale al aire gracias a la aportación económica que tú nos das. Estás escuchando Radio Pacífica KPFK 90.7 FM Los Ángeles, 98.7 FM Santa Bárbara.
On Saturday, November 21st, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., KPFK will hold our annual parking lot sale. Find great deals and savings on various books, CDs, DVDs, and other miscellaneous goodies available for your perusal. All are invited to come browse and buy. Cash, checks, and credit cards are accepted. KPFK is located at 3729 Cahuenga Boulevard West in Studio City, California, right off the Lancashire Boulevard exits of the 101 freeway near the Universal City Red Line station. Again, that's 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday, November the 21st. Call 818-985-2711 for more information.
For KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. Today on the show, Scott Ritter on the Iranian nuclear program, James Bamford on the national surveillance state, and Glenn Greenwald on what the pending trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Manhattan means for the rule of law. I want to dedicate this program to my mom and dad, who taught me the difference between right and wrong, and also how to read. My first guest on my first show here on KPFK will be Scott Ritter. He is a former Marine Corps intelligence officer and UN weapons inspector in Iraq. He's the author of Iraq Confidential, Target Iran, and Waging Peace, The Art of War for the Anti-War Movement. You can find what he writes often at truthdig.com. Welcome to the show, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks very much for joining me today. So everybody knows there's such a thing as the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. And most everybody knows that the U.S. government and even the United Nations have been beating the Iranian government over the head with it, accusing them of all sorts of things. So I want you to explain all about the Iranian nuclear program, but let's start with the actual treaty itself. And what is it that Iran's signature to the NPT actually guarantees? What is it that they promise to fulfill as part of their signature to that treaty, Scott?
Well, when Iran signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, it's a two-way street. Iran is allowed by the world to engage in nuclear-related activities that are of a peaceful nature, primarily energy-related, but also they could be medical isotopes, research and development, etc. What it promises not to do is engage in activities which are related to a military program that is a program designed to create a nuclear device, a nuclear weapon. The mechanism of guaranteeing this is what's called safeguard inspections. The organization responsible for overseeing implementation of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty is the International Atomic Energy Agency, a United Nations organization based in Vienna, Austria. And the IAEA oversees what's called safeguard inspections, that is, inspection activity of declared nuclear facilities and nuclear activity in a signatory nation's sovereign territory to make sure that there is no diversion of fissile material or nuclear material from peaceful purposes to military purposes. Iran signed the NPT, and Iran is obligated to conduct itself in accordance with its obligations. And right now there are safeguard inspections taking place in Iran, and the conclusion of the safeguard inspections is that there's been no diversion of prescribed materials from peaceful programs to military programs. So in short, Iran is in compliance with its NPT obligations.
Well, but I think I found a flaw in your theory there. Everyone on TV, and everyone certainly on AM radio in this country, knows that Iran is making nuclear weapons. Everybody knows they're making nuclear weapons. And it sounds to me like the loophole in what you just said there, Mr. Ritter, is that the IAEA is in charge of making sure that no declared nuclear materials are diverted to a military purpose. So there must be a secret nuclear weapons program in Iran that is not declared and that is not safeguarded by the International Atomic Energy Agency, right?
Well, I mean, these are arguments that are put forward by those who are distrustful of Iran. I'll be the first one to say that I would feel a lot better if Iran and other nations were subjected to a greater degree of safeguard inspections. Indeed, the International Atomic Energy Agency has been trying for a number of years to get Iran to sign on to what's called the Additional Protocol of Inspections, which would give inspectors, you know, a greater latitude to inspect not only declared facilities, but also to carry out inspections of undeclared facilities so that you could search out for, you know, any hidden nuclear program. But the thing that we need to understand here is that you can't go around operating where you make a nation prove the negative. I mean, we saw failure in this in Iraq, where people said Saddam has a biological weapons program, Saddam has a nuclear weapons program, and the declaratory policy was because we said it, it must be so. But there were no facts to back it up. We have to have a fact-based investigation, not a faith-based investigation. And any investigation, any claim about an Iranian nuclear program that lacks solid, substantiated facts as its foundation is basically a fishing expedition, and that's just not how the world operates, and that's not how anybody should operate. The bottom line is, while people can talk about a secret Iranian nuclear program, there is no evidence, there is no fact, there is no data to sustain that. And void of that, we have to go with what we have, which is the reality that all material known to exist in Iraq of a nuclear nature is fully accounted for, and none of this material has been diverted for military use.
In Iran. You said Iraq. You meant Iran.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, so, it's interesting that Mark Hosenball from Newsweek had a web-only exclusive, I guess, about a month ago, where he said that, well, basically, the National Intelligence Council, which means not just the CIA, but all 16 American intelligence agencies, seem to share your same assessment, and that, in fact, they're even standing by that assessment in some sort of international spy conflict argument that they're having with the Israelis and the Germans. And so this isn't just an old conclusion of the CIA. Apparently, according to Hosenball, they've put the CIA, the NIC, National Intelligence Council, has recently put documents on President Obama's desk reaffirming their conclusion from 2007, and they're even sticking to their guns in arguments with the Israelis. Scott, do you know about that?
Well, I mean, I've heard about this. Look, the bottom line is Israel is operating at the extreme range of, analytical activity here. Israel,
you called it, you have in your book Target Iran, you say it's called Concepcion or something, which is basically a fancy name for let's just be conspiracy kooks, right?
Bingo. Israel right now is operating basically on a conspiracy theory type basis for assessing the Iranian nuclear program, because frankly speaking, from Israel's perspective, they can have zero tolerance, zero latitude for error here. But they're wrong across the board. I mean, they're not only wrong factually about Iran in their nuclear capability, they're wrong about the intent of Iran. Basically, Israel's taken everything about Iran and its leadership and gone extreme hard right and taken an extreme position on its conclusions. And these conclusions aren't backed by anything that remotely resembles reality. And so how can you even begin to have a discussion, a debate with Israel on the issue of Iran, because they will not accept anything that doesn't match their extreme conclusion about, what Iran's capabilities are or what their intentions are. This is, again, not a fact-based discussion anymore. It is a faith-based discussion, and that's just not the way to proceed when we're talking about something as serious as nuclear nonproliferation. And frankly speaking, the Israelis don't have a leg to stand on because they themselves are not signatories to the Nonproliferation Treaty, and they themselves have created a nuclear weapons program that's outside the scope of international inspection. So it's sort of hypocritical for Israel to be taking the stance that they had. That doesn't mean that we should turn a blind eye to what Iran is doing, but it means that we have to take anything and everything Israel says about Iran with a grain of salt, because they are not rational when it comes to Iran and nuclear weapons.
This is Anti-War Radio on KPFK in Los Angeles. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Scott Ritter, the former UN weapons inspector and author of Target Iran. And now, Scott, there have been two separate UN Security Council resolutions that insist that Iran suspend all enrichment, that they adopt the additional protocol to their safeguards agreement with the IAEA, and ultimately, that's the demand, isn't it, of the so-called international community, that never mind what it says in the Nonproliferation Treaty, Iran is violating at least this UN resolution, if that counts as law, by enriching uranium at all, even if it is to a measly 3.6% industrial-grade uranium-235. Is that right?
Look, Iran in 2002 got caught off base. Let's be dead frank about this. Iran was proceeding with an enrichment program to enrich uranium to levels necessary to create fuel for a nuclear energy program. But Iran had found that every time it tried to go down that road, it was blocked because of American sanctions or French unwillingness to comply with contractual obligations. And so Iran went the black market route. And they started carrying out activities that weren't declared. And this isn't a problem, because the original Iranian safeguards agreement signed in 1976, you don't have to declare any of this stuff unless you insert nuclear material, unless there's a diversion of nuclear material. Unfortunately for Iran, there were three very minor diversions of nuclear material. I think 1.9 kilograms of uranium hexafluoride feedstock for centrifuges was diverted to test up a centrifuge, an illegal action. They shouldn't have done it. They also tested 50 kilograms of natural uranium as part of a laser enrichment effort. Shouldn't have done it. And they irradiated uranium rods and did an extraction of plutonium, a medical isotope. They extracted, 1 milligram of plutonium, a non-critical amount, but they should have declared it. They didn't. And Iran got caught out, and basically the world said, Iran, you have to come clean. And so Iran did. Part of the agreement of coming clean was Iran said, we will suspend our uranium enrichment program until which time the international inspectors come in and get a baseline inspection of what's going on in Iran, and then put in place an inspection regime. That was estimated to take 6 to 8 months. So there was an agreement between the international community, primarily through the European Union and Iran, where they said Iran will suspend and Iran will agree to these additional inspection protocols. And once the inspectors are in place, Iran will then be allowed to have an enrichment program. Iran did what it was supposed to do. Now, Iran also said that we're going to hold off on final ratification of these new inspection programs until which time, we see if the international community is serious about this. But they said the inspectors can come in and do their job. This was signed and codified in what's called the Tehran Agreement that was signed in 2004. In 2005, under pressure from the United States, the European community reneged on its deal. They said not only must Iran continue to suspend, they will never be allowed to have a nuclear enrichment program. That Iran's suspension has to be permanent. And at this point in time, Iran said that the world violated its agreement. It restarted its enrichment program. And this led to a series of diplomatic actions that resulted in Security Council resolutions being passed condemning Iran for its enrichment effort and demanding that Iran suspend it. But you need to understand that this is the world reneging on its agreement, not Iran reneging on its agreement. Iran did everything it was required to do. And, the bottom line is the world doesn't want Iran to have, when I say the world, United States, Europe, pressured by Israel, does not want Iran to have a nuclear program that gives it technology that could be used in a non-safeguarded inspection environment, could be used for a nuclear weapons program. That means that they're denying Iran, a nation that seeks to have the same technological advantages that the United States and Western Europe has in terms of nuclear energy, they're denying Iran this route, and it's absurd in the extreme. Iran has every right to do what it's doing. Article 4 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty gives Iran this right. Iran is a signatory, and you cannot go and deny Iran its treaty obligations, and yet this is what the United States is doing via the Security Council of the United Nations.
This is Anti-War Radio on KPFK in Los Angeles. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Scott Ritter, the former UN weapons inspector. And now, Broadensanger at the New York Times, as I'm sure you're well aware, Scott, liked to say that the Iranians have enough low-enriched uranium to make a bomb. And then a few paragraphs below, they'll say, oh, yeah, by the way, they would have to enrich it up to above 90% purity, 235, in order to make a single bomb out of it. And obviously, they would have to withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, kick the inspectors out of the country like the North Koreans did in the spring of 2003, and announce to the whole world they're making nuclear bombs. And yet, this is called, and apparently this matters to the Iranians to a degree, too. This is some kind of threshold to stand on in terms of international diplomacy. They call it the breakout capability, that in fact they do have enough low-enriched uranium that if they kicked the inspectors out and withdrew from the NPT, that amount of uranium could be turned into at least one atom bomb worth of nuclear material. And so now the Obama administration has been pushing this deal whereby the Iranians will export some of that low-enriched uranium, which is, again, at this point, approximately 3.6% U-235 industrial grade. They would export that to Russia and have it further enriched to approximately 20%, which is highly enriched uranium, but still not weapons grade. And then it would go from there to France to be formed into fuel rods and then come back to Iran for them to use in their nuclear, their medical reactor. And it seems like perhaps this is a way where all sides can save face. This is a pretty smart deal, it seems like to me, that Obama is pushing for, because he'll be able to tell the Israelis, look, they don't have breakout capability, and the Iranians will be able to tell their people, see, we didn't back down, and we haven't given up our right to enrich, and, you know, Russia certainly doesn't want the Iranians to have weapons-grade material either. They share a border there pretty close, and so I just wonder whether you think that, you know, obviously the headlines are pretty negative about it, but do you think there's a possibility of actually working out a deal here that would really diffuse the tension, the build-up toward war, that this path that we still seem to be on, if you look at the sanctions in the Congress and so forth?
I mean, it's a good deal, but the problem is that what's it a deal to accomplish? I mean, on the one hand, if the Obama administration is serious about this agreement, then it's basically saying that the Security Council resolutions calling for Iran's suspension of enrichment are no longer viable. And it's a de facto acknowledgement that Iran's enrichment program is a viable one that is going to be allowed to continue. Because basically you're taking the product of Iran's enrichment activity and you're inserting it into, you know, legitimacy. You're saying, let's make it into fuel, et cetera. That doesn't seem to be the direction the Obama administration's heading, however. And so Iran's a little bit nervous about getting involved in something that ultimately doesn't give it its what it wants, which is a nuclear enrichment capability to produce fuel for nuclear reactors. This is why the 3.5% level is so important. Iran says that's all they want to enrich to. Now, they have a reactor, a U.S.-built reactor, that that produces medical isotopes. People go, oh, poo-poo, who cares about that? Well, the big deal is that there's a Canadian reactor right now that produces the majority of the world's medical isotopes, and it's shutting down. When it does so, there will be no more medical isotopes. And Iran's saying, no, we're going to have our own capability. Now, this reactor they have, this U.S. reactor, built reactor, is an old reactor. It itself is due to be shut down. And so they're building a new reactor, the Arak reactor, heavy water reactor. People might have heard about that, a lot of talk about it. It's designed to produce medical isotopes. Iran says that they need fuel for this, but Iran doesn't want to produce fuel for that. You see, the centrifuge cascades they have set up right now are optimized to 3.5%. They don't want to reconfigure these cascades to produce anything greater than 3.5% because they know what will happen. People will say, aha, they're positioning themselves for the breakout scenario. And Iran just basically wants to say, no, 3.5% is what we do. They need this fuel. They need it for the Bushehr reactor that's coming online soon. They need it for the reactors that that they're going to, you know, be building down the road. The last thing they want to do is send all their fuel out and have a nation like France impound it and not send it back, renege on the fuel rod shipment. And so Iran's saying, you got to give us some guarantees.
Sounds like the deal actually has that poison pill kind of built into it. I'm sorry, Scott.
Well, it does. I mean, that's the bottom line.
I'm sorry that we're all out of time. I really appreciate your time and your expertise on the show today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Everybody, that's Scott Ritter, former Marine Corps intelligence officer, UN weapons inspector in Iraq. He's the author of Iraq Confidential, Target Iran, and Waging Peace, The Art of War for the Anti-War Movement. You can find what he writes at truthdig.com. You're listening to Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and our next guest today is James Bamford. He's a former producer for ABC World News Tonight. He's the author of the books The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, A Pretext for War, and The Shadow Factory. You can also find some of his journalism in Rolling Stone magazine and at the New York Review of Books. Welcome to the show, Jim. How are you doing?
Well, great, Scott. Thanks.
I really appreciate you joining us on the show today, and I was hoping we could talk a little bit about the anatomy of the American surveillance state, especially as it's developed since September 11th. Now, I think the thing that caught the American people's imagination about this surveillance state, even more than the revelation of the wireless warrantless phone wiretapping in the New York Times, was the leak and the information that came out about Admiral Poindexter's project, Total Information Awareness, and it had the creepy pyramid on the symbol and flipped everybody out. And you write in your book, The Shadow Factory, that after Congress cut off the money for Total Information Awareness over there at the Pentagon, they just renamed it Basketball and moved it over there to NSA headquarters. Is that right?
Yeah, most of what was being done by the Pentagon at that time was sort of put deeper under cover, and a lot of the programs that looked like they would be viable were moved over to NSA.
And so what exactly does Total Information Awareness do? Basically, the important part is the software, right, and its ability to search throughout all the data in the world, or what?
Well, basically, it was the idea was to create a system that was very capable of doing data mining so that it would search through not only the government databases, but also a lot of civilian databases so that, you know, anytime you your car that had a, you know, one of those little things that when you go through a toll booth makes a click, that would show up, or anytime you paid a receipt for or paid a bill for a restaurant or a hotel or bought a book, all these little things would show up in a major database someplace. And then the idea was to have the U.S. government bring all these databases together and then be able to search them at will. The idea was, at least Poindexter's idea, was that by doing this, they would be able to find out who among us would be future terrorists by seeing what we did and what we bought and what we read and that type of thing. So those are the kind of things that were envisioned by Admiral Poindexter at the time. And as you mentioned, a lot of those data mining capabilities were switched over to NSA.
So does that mean that your average high-tech 21st century American can count on the fact that everything he searches, all his emails and instant chat messages and the rest of that is all being saved by the government there?
Well, the problem is there's very little knowledge about what the government, what the NSA is doing, because everything was kept very secret, especially during the lead up to the new Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act amendments last year. So what they did do, they decreased the authorization of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to oversee a lot of NSA's activities, and they at the same time increased NSA's capabilities and legal authorities to eavesdrop on American communications. It's hard to know exactly what the NSA is doing in terms of access to U.S. databases because everything's totally secret. One indication, however, in terms of what they may be planning to do in the future comes from enormous building projects that they have going. One of them is to build a, actually was just started a few weeks ago, a project to build a data storage and analysis facility in Utah that will be 1 million square feet. And that's the size of the U.S. Capitol building plus a third. And it will use so much power, I mean, to power the computers and all the search equipment, that it will use the same amount of electricity as all the homes in Salt Lake City put together. And at the same time, they're sort of finishing up. I think it's in the final stages of another data center. This one's almost the size of the Alamo Dome, and it's being built down in San Antonio, Texas. So you've got these brand new, first of all, you had all this new authority being given to NSA, and then the second point was that they just built all these brand new data facilities that they never had before, enormous data storage facilities and data mining facilities. So, you know, whatever that means, and I would think that would mean that NSA is expanding greatly its data retrieval capabilities.
This is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with James Bamford, author of The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA, from 9/11 to the eavesdropping on America. And now when you talk about the amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978 there, basically I think you're referring to when the Democrats legalized what Bush was doing criminally, and they said, well, you have to get back within the jurisdiction of the FISA court, but then they changed the law so that the FISA court can give out general warrants about certain categories of information that may be intercepted rather than targeting individuals that there's any particular level of evidence that they've actually done anything wrong. Is that right?
Well, it's extremely complicated, the new legislation. But basically, yeah, what it indicated was that from now on, the FISA court, which was originally created in 1978, in order to approve or have basically a check and a balance on NSA, anytime NSA wanted to eavesdrop on a U.S. citizen or what they call a U.S. person in the U.S., which is virtually anybody that doesn't have diplomatic immunity, anytime that the NSA wanted to do that on a U.S. person in the United States, it had to get the prior authorization or a warrant, what they actually call an order, from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And what the amendments to the FISA Act did was it sort of did away with that requirement and instead authorized the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to, instead of individual warrants, to approve NSA's eavesdropping techniques. So in other words, NSA would say, we're going to eavesdrop on various groups using this method here, and then the court would approve that as opposed to saying we're going to eavesdrop on Bill Jones and listen to his communications, and they don't do the individual warrants anymore unless it's a U.S. citizen, I think two U.S. citizens in the U.S., something like that. But generally, the court was decreased in its oversight capability of the NSA.
Mm-hmm. Well, and at the same time, as you say, they're building these massive new storage facilities in Utah and San Antonio and in other places. And I guess this is a good point to bring up what to me is an incredibly important question, Jim, and that is, what is a yottabyte?
Well, it's a one with a lot of zeros after it. I think it's actually 24 zeros after a 10 with 24 zeros. It's a yottabyte is a measurement of data. It's you know, most people are familiar with a megabyte or a kilobyte of information, and it's the amount of information in a computer, basically, is being held as data, and a yottabyte is the highest amount that they've come up with terms for. I think before a yottabyte, there's a zettabyte, and so forth. So there's various terms, but yottabyte right now I think is 10 to the 24th, or septillion operations, or rather septillion bytes.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of information, what it is.
And, a septillion. And, so that's basically, that means everything ever published by humanity can basically be stored in one Alamo Dome-sized warehouse in San Antonio.
Yeah, that's right. It's it's an enormous amount of information. The reason that came up was that the MITRE Corporation was looking into the amount of data that was being that is capable of being stored because of all the surveillance sensors that the United States has. It requires a great deal of data, not just eavesdropping, but other types, imagery and so forth. So they did a study looking at how much data would be needed to would need to be stored at some time in the future. And I think it was a former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency suggested that we would probably need a yottabyte of data storage in the future. And so anyway, that's the that was why that term came up. And that might be the amount of information they need to store in these mega data centers, you know, data center, a million square feet and so forth.
Well, now, Jim, is there really such a thing as software that's fancy enough to be able to do anything with that information? When you're talking about everything ever published by humankind, how smart is a computer to know what's important and what's not important and all that?
Well, that's always been the problem with NSA, is the technology, the hardware and software necessary to acquire the information has always been far in advance of the capability of the humans to understand the information that's being acquired. So you can pull in enormous amounts of information, but if you still lack the capability to understand languages, the key languages, or if you lack the number of personnel that can actually sift through a lot of that, then it's a fairly useless and very costly waste of money.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the other hand, they do have some pretty fancy software, though, don't they?
Well, they do, and the question is whether that software is capable of searching through this electronic haystack for the right needle. The problem is that the NSA's had a fairly not an overly successful record in the past. I mean, it missed the 9/11 attack, or rather the first attack on the World Trade Center in 1993, and then it missed the attack on the coal, it missed the USS Cole, it missed the attack on the East African embassies, and it missed 9/11, as well as missing the attacks in London and Madrid. So, you know, that's the problem, is that the agency has been collecting a lot of information, but for one reason or another, either they haven't had the language capabilities, or they haven't had the personnel, or it hasn't been targeted in the right area. Whatever, they've missed all these major terrorism incidents.
Mm-hmm. Well, for those of us who worry about, you know, all of this stuff that's being used to eavesdrop on all of us and spy on all of us, that it'll end up being used against us to violate our liberty, if perhaps we can breathe easy that they're incompetent and they won't be able to completely enslave us with all this data that they have on us.
Well, they've improved the capabilities. So that, I mean, it could be seen in the in a recent case where Major Nadel Hassan was, it was discovered that NSA had actually picked up between a dozen and 20 emails that he had between him and Anwar Awlaki in Yemen. And NSA at that point, I mean, they did pick up the emails, and they did, the system worked well in terms of NSA's capability at that point. They picked up the emails, and then they passed them on to the FBI. But, you know, the emails were very ambiguous, so they didn't think it was there was any danger there. And once again, we had another terrorist incident, that even though the NSA at this time had picked up the information, or picked up some information that didn't stop the terrorist act from taking place.
Yeah, well, data is no substitute for wisdom, is it?
No, and
or even knowledge.
Well, and the problem is there's only a certain amount of knowledge and wisdom you can gain from reading emails, and that's where human intelligence is most useful. Human intelligence in this case would have been picking up the indications from non-secret sources, such as simply the conversations he had with other doctors and so forth. Or, you know, the ultimate way to prevent this was to have good gun control so that guns aren't easily purchased. I mean, one of the indications here was he purchased 13 magazines for a handgun. I mean, that should set off a little warning light someplace. If somebody goes into a gun shop and has one gun and buys 13 magazines for it. So there's a lot of indicators out there that maybe this might have happened, but they were from human sources, not from signals intelligence or eavesdropping or this expensive NSA that we have.
Mm-hmm. Well, something tells me that as these systems get more integrated, the local police will be able to pull you over for having an outstanding problem with the IRS or something like that. They'll be perfectly capable of using this to persecute regular Americans. It's stopping dangerous threats that they're apparently unable to take care of.
Well, it seems to be the paradox, is that the more we're spending on all this surveillance equipment, the less we are able of stopping these incidents. So, I don't know what the answer is, but just looking at the history of the amount of money that goes into these surveillance techniques and these surveillance agencies, it makes you wonder the value.
It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with James Bamford here, wrapping up. One thing that you talk about in your book, The Shadow Factory, Jim, is I think it's called Crystal City and the Security Industrial Complex, where every businessman with a gadget has found a way to reach into the public honeypot, and that is by selling spy equipment to the government for the use against his neighbors. And that seems like a major – that incentive structure for all this surveillance seems built in and permanent, just like Ike Eisenhower's military-industrial complex.
Well, it is. It's a surveillance-industrial complex, and the primary convention for that type of thing is something I wrote about, nicknamed the eavesdropper's balls, when all these people that, that produce these surveillance devices get together once a year at a big convention and sell these things to the U.S. government and to a large extent to private industry. So surveillance, what Eisenhower warned of, is a military-industrial complex, and not only that, we have to worry today about the surveillance-industrial complex, which to some degree is advancing faster than the military-industrial complex.
All right, everybody. That is James Bamford joining us here on Anti-War Radio on KPFK. He's the author of The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, A Pretext for War, and the latest is The Shadow Factory, the ultra-secret NSA from 9/11 to the eavesdropping on America. Thanks very much for your time on the show today, Jim.
My pleasure, Scott.
This is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. And finally today, I'd like to welcome to the show Glenn Greenwald. He's a former constitutional litigator. He writes the excellent blog at salon.com/opinion/Greenwald. He's got his own podcast show there, Salon Radio, and he's the author of How Would a Patriot Act? A Tragic Legacy and Great American Hypocrites. And I know at least two out of three of those are New York Times bestsellers. Welcome to the show, Glenn. How are you doing?
Great to be here, Scott. Thanks very much.
Well, I'm very happy to have you here. Now, I was just speaking with James Bamford about the structure of the surveillance state as it's been built up, especially through the Bush administration and through today. And it seems like we're at this real crisis. And this is something that you cover a lot in your writings on your blog there at salon.com. And that is where We have this old law that was written at a time when the average citizens were as well armed as the state, known as our glorious Bill of Rights, for example. And now we have a situation where the state is, their access to technology and to weaponry and so forth is so much out of balance from that of regular people. It seems like all we have is the old law that's protecting us from the unleashing of a total Orwellian society upon us. And what you are always writing about is the collapse of that rule of law and the precedents that continue to be set by Republicans and Democrats in all parts of the government that basically no longer that prove that their authority is no longer limited by the law and that they can in fact do whatever they want with us. How bad of a crisis is this? How bad am I perhaps overstating this?
I don't think you're overstating it at all. I think if you look at the way that our system of government was designed, the limitation that was supposed to be placed on the power of the government was embodied in all sorts of laws, principally the Constitution, and the idea that the founders of our country understood was that the politicians don't voluntarily abide by limitations on their power, that they need some reason, some incentive, some mechanism to force them to abide by it. And one of the principal instruments that they envisioned that would allow these limitations to be enforced was that the different branches of government would compete with one another, would fight with one another, would fight for power. And in that struggle for different branches having power, there would be a balance and checks that would be imposed on them. And then on top of that, there would be other checks and limitations, such as an adversarial media that was protected by the First Amendment, and ultimately, if all of that failed, the people would be responsible for enforcing their own rights and for safeguarding their own liberties. And I think what you've seen is a failure on all of those fronts. We have, instead of a balanced system of government with the different branches, we have an executive branch that is far stronger and more powerful than the other two, and that becomes even more true in a time of war, which we seem perpetually to be involved in, and you have a media that is far more interested in serving government power than checking it. And then at the end of the day, you have a citizenry that is either apathetic or that has become convinced, for the reason that you said, that it's really incapable of checking government power. And so I think what you have is a government that no longer feels that it needs to abide by the law, that it's free to break the law, and does so continuously and without consequence. And I think that's the real crisis.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as you've shown on your blog over and over as well, as the government acts with complete impunity and lawlessness, they apply more and more rules and regulations and laws and restrictions to personal behavior of American citizens than could even be imagined, really. I mean, I think we all know if they really had 100% enforcement of all the federal and state laws on the books, we'd all be in the gulag right now. It's and people can go to prison for the most minor thing and spend major portions of their lives behind bars.
Well, that's what, you know, I find the most disturbing aspect of all of this is, you know, if we had a very permissive society, which basically believed that people should break the law and get a lot of flexibility and a lot of leniency and a lot of forgiveness and not really be punished, that would be one thing if it applied to everybody. But that belief only applies to our politically powerful and financial elites. The opposite principle actually applies to everybody else, namely ordinary Americans, which is, there's no leniency, there's no mercy, there's no forgiveness. So that while our political elites break the law continuously without consequences, the exact opposite happens for the rest of the society, which is we are the largest prison state in the entire world. And if you look at the prison population of the entire world, 25% of prisoners worldwide, 25% are in the United States, even though we are only 5% of the world's population. We imprison more of our citizens than any other country in the world, including far larger countries like China and India and others. We punish people with prison for small and petty crimes that nowhere else in the rest of the world virtually is punishable by prison sentences. And of course, the drug laws are the most oppressive and draconian of all. And so what you really have is a total breach of the core American premise, which is supposed to be that even though we're going to be unequal in terms of our financial status and our intellect and our power that we wield, the one place that we would all be equal is before the law. That was really the central promise of the American political system, and it was what made all the other inequities tolerable and justifiable, and that has really been eroded, so that we now have a two-tiered system of justice where the powerful are exempt from law-breaking, and ordinary Americans, when they break the law, even petty laws, have the full weight of the criminal justice system come crashing down upon them.
Now, one of the kind of leading examples, the quintessential case of all of this, I think, is, as you mentioned before, it's tied up in the war on terrorism. And I think it's pretty fair to say that George Bush, through his absolute ignorance of the American system and the law as he was supposed to be faithfully executing it, just rolled right over for Dick Cheney and David Addington and their theory that all of this should be treated not just as a war, but even outside the laws of war. And that instead of George Bush saying, hey, look, we're going to take this opportunity to prove to the whole world what it's like to have a constitutional government and what it's like to have a Bill of Rights, and we're going to spread liberty by the light of our example, they went and did the exact opposite. They completely abandoned the law. They legalized, quote-unquote, at least, torture. And now we see the Obama administration, it's all the headlines, that the Obama administration is going to go ahead and put Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four others, I believe including Ramzi bin al-Shib, on trial for the 9/11 attack in New York. And here I was trying to celebrate, Glenn, I wanted to celebrate that this major misdirection, this wrong path taken after 9/11 could somehow be put back on track. And then I pulled up your blog and you said, no such luck. Why is that? Why is it that putting Khalid Sheikh Mohammed on trial in New York is nothing to celebrate for the Fifth Amendment, for the rule of law?
Well, I actually do think that it's the right decision to take the 9/11 defendants and put them on trial, because one of the central premises of our system of justice is that before the government can put people into cages for life or to kill them, they have to be charged with the crime and given a trial to make sure that they're actually guilty of that of which they're being accused. Thomas Jefferson said that trial by jury is the only instrument ever devised by mankind to ensure government adheres to the limitations of the Constitution. So I actually applaud the Obama administration for giving trials to those five individuals. That's what the American justice system is about. The problem is that they're not going to give trials to all of the people they want to keep in prison in the war on terror, so-called war on terror. They're going to give trials to some if they are convinced that they can win in a courtroom and get a guilty verdict. They will give trials to some people. To other people where their case is weaker, they will put before military commissions, which are these new invented tribunals that allow the government much greater flexibility to win, and there's far lesser due process for the defendant. So if the government thinks they can't win in a real court, they'll put you in a kind of quasi-court, a military commission. And then if the government believes or doubts that they can even beat you and prove your guilt in a military commission where all the rules are fixed in their favor, then they reserve the right to simply indefinitely detain you, meaning to imprison you for as long as they want without charging you with any crime and without ever giving you any tribunal, a military commission or a real court. And so what really the Obama administration is doing is not giving trials to everybody. That would be something to applaud if they were actually recognizing that principle that trials are a fundamental part of our political culture. Instead, what they're doing is they're creating a multi-tier justice system so that they give you the amount of due process only to the extent that they know that they can win. And however much due process they can give you and still be assured ahead of time that they're going to get a conviction against you, that's the due process that you get. And really what they're doing is they're just picking and choosing where you go based on how certain it is that you'll be convicted. And a system of justice that has different levels of due process for different defendants, that the state gets to pick and choose based on this, making sure that they always are certain ahead of time that they will win, is not a justice system. It's really a rigged game of show trials. And that's what the Obama administration is setting up. And they led the announcement by trumpeting the five 9/11 defendants that they're going to send to a real trial. But as part of that announcement, there are several others, including a Canadian who was 15 years old at the time that we abducted him from Afghanistan, who aren't going to get trials at all. They're going to get military commissions. And there are still others who won't get any charges at all. And I find that almost as disturbing as not giving trials to anybody.
This is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Glenn Greenwald. It's interesting, you bring up this case of Omar Khadr, right, is the juvenile you're speaking of there?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and we already know, I already know from talking with Andy Worthington and other lawyers, this has been published around. This kid is innocent. That's why they have to give him this bogus system, this star chamber trial, is because somebody else threw the grenade. They paid off witnesses to say he threw a grenade. And it's not a war crime to throw a grenade at an invading soldier in your country in the first place. And the whole thing was a giant joke. That's why they have to give him a star chamber trial, because he didn't do anything.
Well, that's exactly what I mean. And if you look at what happened there, as you say, you know, when we think about what terrorists are and the type of people that were supposedly shipping thousands of miles away across the globe from their home to an island prison that we've built at Guantanamo, we are told that these people are terrorists. We think about, you know, people who are plotting or have engaged in violence against civilians, like the attacks of September 11th. And yet here is somebody who was in Afghanistan when the United States invaded, and he threw a grenade at one of our soldiers, allegedly. That's the accusation. Now, throwing a grenade at a soldier in an invading army is the most common and legal act of war there is. And yet we abducted him when he was 15 years old and shipped him across the world, and he's now been held in prison in Guantanamo for 7 years without any charges of any kind. And as you say, this began as a criminal investigation, and the more evidence they gathered, the more obvious it became that he didn't actually even do that which he was accused of doing. And so the Obama administration knows that if they give him a real trial, they're going to lose. And so, as you say, they're giving him this lesser form of justice. And that is, you know, a military commission where the rules are essentially fixed in the favor of the government. It's almost impossible for them to lose. And that is what I was just describing. That's what makes it so dangerous.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, you mentioned before about perpetual war. And, you know, the idea that war is the health of the state. If you think of all the changes in our system of law just since September 11th in terms of the expansion of the power of the NSA, the Patriot Act, the Department of Homeland Security, the TSA at the airports, changes in guidelines where the FBI can now go on fishing expeditions and investigate people instead of crimes, we're never, ever going to be able to get rid of any of this as long as we're in a state of permanent warfare, as long as the senator can go on an MSNBC in the morning and say, no, the danger, the terrible Islamic terrorist menace against us.
Well, I think that's one of the most, you know, important points is if you look at the whole national security apparatus that currently spies on us and detains us and continues to pour incredible amounts of money into building up our military vastly beyond any other country in the world. It began, you know, essentially 60 years ago during World War II. And once World War II was over, they kept finding justifications to support it and sustain it, even though the original justification had come to an end. And, of course, the Cold War and all of our various wars as part of that sustained it for a long time. And once the Cold War ended, we very quickly found a new enemy to replace it, a new permanent enemy, which was terrorism. And so what you find now is that essentially the United States over the last 60 years has been a nation more or less permanently at war. I mean, we'll start a war maybe stop one, but we're constantly engaged in military actions in other countries. We're constantly bombing, invading, and occupying other countries. We fight and start and wage more wars than any other country by far combined. And beyond the obvious cost of war, you know, the loss of our lives, of our citizens, the people that we kill in the countries that we bomb, the huge amounts of money that we incinerate based on these foreign adventures, a country that is permanently at war ends up having their political liberties and political culture degraded inevitably. As I mentioned earlier, you vest huge amounts of power in the president and make him this omnipotent, centralized figure. You accept far more claims of secrecy and erosion of civil liberties during wartime than you do when you're at peace. James Madison, in his political tract, Political Observations in 1790, said, of all the enemies of true liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded. No nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. And the reason for that is clear, is a nation that constantly fights war will constantly err on the side of lesser freedom, lesser civil liberties, more government power, and more secrecy. And obviously a country like ours, that's been more or less permanently at war for the last 60 years, and will continue to be at war, even under the best case scenario, for at least another decade. Mm-hmm. Is a nation where liberties are being eroded and government power constantly expanded.
Well, now, as it gets worse and worse, more and more people around the society are waking up to the fact that they're losing their liberty, that they're losing the lives of their family members in these wars. And I guess the real hope is if we're going to be able to do anything about this, Glenn, we're going to have to put aside this left-right division, this country versus rock and roll, this liberals versus conservatism, this madness that people are stuck in, and we're going to have a real realignment where people who love the Bill of Rights and who want to be free and want their kids to be free and live in a society at peace are going to have to put aside those differences and realign against this national government, its empire, and its destruction of our Bill of Rights. Is that possible?
I think it is possible, and I think you've seen a lot of issues over the past couple of years that have been really transcending the sort of cliche left versus right dynamic that the ruling class uses to keep people distracted and divided. You know, there was a lot of anger, for example, over the government bailout of Wall Street, where we suddenly transferred $700 billion to the very people who corruptly destroyed the economy. And you saw rage and anger and resentment on the part of what our government was doing from both the right and the left. You've seen opposition to the war, to the Iraq war, and to our general war policy from both the right and the left increasingly. And, you know, I just today, several leading conservatives, David King of the American Conservative Union and Grover Norquist and Bob Barr, the former Republican congressman from Georgia, and Libertarian presidential candidate, issued a statement supporting Obama's decision to give trials to the 9/11 defendants and urged that all detainees in the war on terror that we want to detain be given trials, because that's just a basic American value. It's not conservative or liberal. It's dangerous to allow the government to imprison people without charging them with the crime. So I think that you are seeing, and especially as people get more dissatisfied and angry with the political class and see that not much changes, even when we change parties and even when a candidate runs on a platform of quote-unquote change, very little actually changes. I think people start to abandon the idea that salvation lies in picking and choosing between Democrats and Republicans, or taking part in the standard conservative versus liberal political debates, and returning to core political values and opposing pervasive corruption. And I think much more important of a dichotomy than left versus right or Democrat versus Republican is insider, outsider. And I think that you're starting to see that in a lot of ways.
All right, everybody. That's Glenn Greenwald. He's a former constitutional lawyer. His invaluable blog can be found at salon.com/opinion/Greenwald. Thanks very much for your time on the show today, Glenn.
My pleasure, Scott. Bye-bye.
Anti-War Radio on KPFK is produced by Adam Yage, engineered by Lana Inskime. I'm your host and executive producer, Scott Horton.